Our next speaker, and I was sort of excited because Nate said, you know, I've been collecting all these years, and I just heard about this place. This is wonderful. So I hope you all also welcome Nate for those that are old Arskers and so on. And one of the reasons I belong to Arsk is to come hear presentations like his. Nate's a, he's worked with the Archives of Traditional Music for the past 2 years in Indiana University, where he's a graduate student in the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology. He's also the author of a recently published book, which is what he'll be talking about, called The Star Day Story, The House That Country Music Built, published by the University of Mississippi Press. He's presently producing an audio documentary about Star Day for public radio and collaborating with several country music discographies with Hillbilly Researcher Publications, which I think is in the UK, if I'm reading the notes correctly, as well as liner notes for projects with Ace Records and Bear Family. His topic is, as I said, the Star Day Story, Lefty Frizzell, Bluegrass, and the King Connection. Welcome, Nate.
Probably the one that says Star Day. Looks good. Looks good. Slideshow. I apologize. My PowerPoint skills are not brushed up, but we'll deal with what we've got. I do want to thank you for having me at ARSC. I am excited about the organization. And Tom's paper was great on Bob Wills. And for hearing things like that is very exciting for me. I'll be talking about my Star Day records and country music research, which I've been doing for about 9 years now. And today I'd like to share with you a few things that I've learned from collecting, researching, and writing about Star Day records. An empire built on East Texas honky-tonk, rockabilly, bluegrass, western swing, cowboy trios, old-time string bands, Cajun music, jug bands, gospel quartets, square dance jigs, cornball comedians, basically anything that's ever been at one time or another consumed under that umbrella of country music. And within this paper, let's see, right. Within this paper, I'll provide a brief introduction to the label, beginning with the formation of Star Day, the Lefty Frizzell, to the subsequent move to Nashville, the Bluegrass Boom, to the merging of King Records. Through this brief representation of the beginning, middle, and end of Star Day, I hope to illuminate some of the label's unique recording and marketing practices, which helped establish it as a widely recognized and collected independent record label. And I contend that today Star Day deserves a place in the canon of not just significant country music labels, but in that of America's most important independent record labels. Contrary to the Nashville-era logo's claim that the label was founded in 1952, Star Day was actually founded in 1953. 3 years earlier, in 1950, country music sensation Lefty Frizzell was on tour playing a gig at Neva's Cafe in Beaumont, Texas, when his path crossed with Burl Houston Starnes Jr. Some of you may know him as Jack Starnes. That's insider stuff. He never told anybody his name was Burl. Got that information from his daughter. So after following Frizzell and his band for a week, catering to their every need, Starnes was hired as Frizzell's manager, and two prosperous years followed. By 1951, Frizzell owned his own private plane, his own tour bus, numerous number one Billboard hits, and his popularity in country music was rivaled only by Hank Williams Sr. Touring Canada in the winter of 1951 with continuous crisscross bookings soon took its toll, and the Frizzell-Starnes relationship soured. Frizzell canceled 20 appearances. Starnes sued Frizzell for $25,000. Frizzell countersued for $50,000. Starnes counter-countersued for $100,000. They settled out of court in June of 1952, and Lefty's wife Alice remembered that just to get Starnes out of his life, after all was said and done, he paid over $25,000 and, quote, he didn't have a dime left. Thus, the seeds were planted not only for a great country music song, but that of a great country music label. By October of 1952, Starnes had a plan. In a letter written to Country Song Roundup that same month, he wrote, quote, a good recording company is first, good songs are next, An artist that is willing to work and cooperate is next. Then you go from there. He already had several cooperative artists lined up, several good songs. Now he needed a good recording company. How then did Starnes meet Harold Westcott Daly, otherwise known as Pappy Daly? I don't know. I actually have zero idea. But Pappy was surely aware of Starnes' role as a manager of Lefty Frizzell. And Starnes and his wife, Neva, owned multiple nightclubs in Beaumont, Texas, and Neva ran her own booking agency as well. Conversely, Jack Starnes was surely aware of Pappy Daly. His reputation as a LA-based, a producer for the LA-based four-star label, jukebox operator, music distributor, and by 1935, Billboard magazine reported that Daly was the largest operator of music in Texas. He opened his own record store in Houston in 1956 called Daly's Record Ranch and quickly garnered a reputation as one of the top record men in the state of Texas. Sometime in the late 1940s, Daly inked a deal with Bill McCall, which made him Four Star's Texas distributor, and in exchange, he rounded up local talent, recorded them at his own expense, sent the masters to Four Star. He convinced Four Star to press it, guaranteed that they would make money by buying enough of them back to give them a profit, and then he put them on all of his jukeboxes throughout Texas and essentially became a one-man hit-making machine. While McCall's pockets got bigger, he never offered Daly a discount. It wasn't long before Daly realized he was being taken advantage of, so he discontinued his relationship in 1952, roughly the same time Starnes severed his relationship with Frizzell. According to Daly's son, Bud Daly, Starnes approached Pappy with the idea for a label. Daly, after all, operated a record store, and he knew what people wanted to buy. In this regard, I think Astarte as a country music version of Herb Abramson's Atlantic Records, or Herman Lubinsky's Savoy, or Ike and Ben Berman's Apollo, or even John Dolphin's Recorded in Hollywood, in that the label owners also owned record stores, and the music that they sold in the record store was often dictated by the type of music recorded by the record label. Daly's record shop experience gave him keen sense of what could and could not sell, as well as direct contact with the country music consumer for suggestions and feedback. Though he was initially reluctant, he succumbed to Starnes' record label idea, and the Starde label, a combination of the two men's last names, was born. The first 78 masters were cut on May 21st of 1953, and Billboard announced the label on June 20th of 1953. Surprisingly, with just their fourth release, Arlie Duff's spirited Y'all Come, which became Bill Monroe's closing song, started to garner national attention. Among those who took notice, Don Pierce, a former economics major at University of Washington, and again, that's super insider stuff, because Don never told anybody that he was a business major, much less would he ever tell anybody he was from Washington. When he was in Nashville, Tennessee, he spoke in an affected Southern accent and really put on the good old boy routine for folks. He had just recently separated himself from Four Star, and in August of 1953, Pierce found out that Pappy Daly was connected to this new label, so he phoned Daly and offered his services. Once in Houston, Don Pierce was acquainted with Starnes, and the three men founded the Starde Recording and Publishing Company. Each man contributed $333 to the cause, and each man owned one-third of the Starde pie. Starnes became the designated talent scout, Daly was in charge of record production, and Pierce, who became the only full-time employee, was designated as Starde president and returned to California to set up the corporation. Though oftentimes Starde is thought of as a Texas label, it was technically a West Coast label, as designated by its office headquarters on West Pico Boulevard, right here in sunny Los Angeles, California. From 1953 to 1956, the Starde label capitalized on the current popular local music trends of East Texas, and in the first 3 years, I find this astonishing, 3 years, had released nearly 500 country music singles. That's a bunch. Comprising one of the largest catalogs of recorded honky-tonk music, characterized by the steel guitar, twin fiddles, electric rhythm guitar, and honky-tonk piano, the Starde label effectively captured one of the liveliest music scenes in American music history and preserved an important stage in the development of popular country music. One of the reasons Starde was able to release so many singles in such a short period of time was their use of a custom recording service, sometimes referred to as the Dixie label. Don Pierce had run a similar custom service for Four Star, in which anybody could send in a recording they had made, along with $85. Four Star would press up 300 copies and send those to the artist. The deal was profitable for the artist, who could now sell a record at personal shows, as well as Four Star, who not only made that $85, but retained publishing rights to all of the songs. It was through this custom process that 4Star achieved one of its greatest successes when Slim Willett sent in a tape, ordered 300 copies of a song he had just written called Don't Let the Stars Get in Your Eyes. Not long after that, it became a number one country hit in 1952, and Perry Como made it a number one pop hit the same year. Realizing a vast potential for new publishing material, new stars, royalties from airplay, income from more business, Pierce set up the identical service, almost, with a few new features at Starday Records. Now, when an artist purchased 300 copies of a record, the artist also got 100 record mailers pre-addressed to radio stations within a three-state area, and the new service also touted better vinyl and the opportunity to use the Starday logo on the record label, thus being able to bill yourselves as a Starday recording artist without actually being on Starday or having a contract with the label. Fees for the service were initially set at $115, ranging from professionally recorded touring bands to amateurs singing in their kitchens. The custom series provided a refreshing alternative to major label production ideals and presented performers and bands recording the music the way they wanted it to be heard. Now, the concept of Vanity Records, which is records paid for and distributed by singers and musicians themselves, is certainly not groundbreaking. Both Columbia and Victor's Canadian Vision began pressing personal records as early as 1910, and Patrick Feaster's over there, and I'm sure he, as well as others, could educate me a great deal more on Vanity custom pressings. But still, Starday's service easily created the largest body of independently recorded country music in the golden era of the genre, and introduced the world to the sounds of Willie Nelson, that's his first record ever right there on Starday Custom, from 1957, as well as Link Ray, who recorded with his buddy, his brother, Lucky Ray, and Doug Vernon. By 1956, Starnes had sold out, Starnes had sold out of Starday, and the label was now owned by Pierce and Daly, who were achieving grand success with one of Starnes' brightest prospects, George Jones. George was in the national charts with several hits, considered by many to be among the fastest rising talents in country music, and who had also dabbled in with rock and roll as Thumper Jones. Among those who paid close attention to Jones' success was Irv Green of Mercury Records. Having just passed on purchasing Elvis Presley's recording contract from Sam Phillips, a much regretted move, to say the least, he was now looking to boost his country music roster in hopes of finding Mercury's own successor to Presley in the rock and roll throne. George Jones was that hope. In January of 1957, Starday and Mercury were merged and formed the Mercury Starday Country Series. D. Kilpatrick, who was leaving Nashville's A&R position at Mercury to take over the Grand Ole Opry, arranged it so that Daly was the Texas Mercury distributor, who also booked Grand Ole Opry talent. Pierce moved from L.A. to Nashville to take over Kilpatrick's role as A&R man, and Pierce later described it as a three-way deal between the Grand Ole Opry, Mercury Records, and himself. 53 singles were released, 5 LPs, that's it. They included hits by Jimmy Skinner and George Jones, as well as the first ever recordings by Roger Miller and the Big Bopper. But most significant to Pierce was his introduction to bluegrass music, which is where he met and produced recordings by Bill Clifton, Jim Eanes, Denver Duke, the Stanley Brothers, and Carl Story. After 1 year, Starday had yet to deliver the next Elvis Presley, and Mercury, with the exception of 4 artists, discontinued their entire country music division, essentially giving up on country music as a sellable product. The breakup not only divorced Mercury from Starday, but Pierce and Daly split the entire Starday catalog in half and went their separate ways as well. As Mercury and other labels began to scale back country music production in favor of rock and roll, others, such as RCA, Columbia, Decca, and some of the majors, were looking for alternatives within the genre. So I have to gloss over this, and I hate to do so quickly because it sounds trite, but in 1957, Chet Atkins suggested adding a full chorus to back up Jim Reeves' hit song, Four Walls, and the new sound was born, which is dubbed the Nashville Sound. I can't go too much more into that, but we're all familiar with, I think, the Nashville Sound. Most major labels adopted the idea that to compete in the ever-changing country music market, they also had to adapt to this new sound. Don Pierce, however, I find it very interesting, he took a different approach. With major labels making the gradual shift to the smoother pop country crossover sound, he revived the Starday name in Nashville by signing those artists who were dropped by the major labels. Bluegrass musicians, who represented a stark contrast to that Nashville sound, were typically the first to go. By 1958, bluegrass had a small, though loyal, fan base, and Pierce was drawn to it. He knew it was a niche market, but that also meant there was a market, and somebody should supply it. So in a few short months, Pierce had acquired the services of nearly every major bluegrass act. on the circuit. Oh, yeah, that's Introduction to Bluegrass. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, that's George Jones. Yeah, there we go. There's a few of the bluegrass acts that were signed to Starday. Ralph Stanley, Bill Clifton, Jesse McReynolds have all told me that Pierce was able to do this because he was essentially the only entrepreneur actively seeking bluegrass at the time. By 1959, Starday had earned its reputation as the bluegrass label, and by 1960, Pierce had amassed the largest active bluegrass catalog in the world. Many of these acts played a very progressive style of bluegrass, but rather than marketing it as the modern sound of bluegrass or hot new sounds of today, Pierce took the opposite approach. On the sleeve to every bluegrass single, as well as the other Starday releases, read the headline, "Preserving the Heritage of American Country Music." I find this fascinating. More importantly, he primarily issued music on LP, and this is, to me, the funniest cover in the history of ever. I don't know if you would agree, but he wanted to do a bluegrass album, but he didn't know what a banjo looked like, and so I might be the only person who finds this weird, but there are five pegs on the headstock of that banjo, and if you've ever seen a five-string banjo, I don't know why you would put the middle peg in the middle of the headstock, but it's hilarious to me. At a time when other labels would not even consider producing bluegrass or country music singles, Pierce recognized that his audience consisted of working-class adults, not teenagers, and that LPs were the desired medium. Littered throughout the expensive four-color LP jackets were the words traditional, authentic, preservation, roots, or in this case, the real McCoy, and my personal favorite, true country music. I find the latter particularly surprising, considering that Billboard's country charts were categorized as hillbilly until 1950, when then the name changed to country and western. In 1958, they dropped the western, it became just country music, and 1 year later, Pierce is already defining what true country music really is. I'm not suggesting that Pierce started that never-ending, ongoing authenticity debate within country music, but he added a fascinating chapter for sure. By marketing his music as traditional and authentic, Pierce converted current progressive bluegrass music, I think here of the Country Gentlemen and all sorts of really innovative bands. He turned bluegrass music into a heritage or a throwback category, blurring the lines between old-time and bluegrass, marketing nostalgia for a style of music that was current and ever-evolving. And it worked. Perhaps most interesting about this approach was his subtle jab at his new home. In contrast to the California-Texas days of Starday, which heavily relied upon and promoted a local music scene, Pierce went out of his way to revive a record label in Nashville by marketing himself as the antithesis of the Nashville sound. As Pierce kept busy stockpiling bluegrass masters throughout the early 60s, America was busy falling in love with the five-string banjo, and the folk explosion resulted. As the trend passed on through the early 60s, nearly every major news source was spotlighting bluegrass music, and in 1960, Time magazine reported that the five-string banjo was the most popular instrument in America. The trend, however, was short-lived. By 1966, buried deep in the pages of the trade publications were several smaller, less noticeable articles about the decline of bluegrass music's popularity. Despite Pierce's best efforts to repackage previous hits and older material with new and exciting cover art, its day in mainstream culture had come and gone. In a somewhat heated debate with Neil Rosenberg in 1967, which I highly recommend if you're interested in bluegrass music because it's incredibly comical, via the Bluegrass Unlimited Letters to the Editor Forum, Pierce blamed the downfall of bluegrass sales to its association with Vietnam War protesters, pill poppers, dope takers, and free love. Rosenberg countered that the Starday catalog was outdated. The debate raged on for several issues, though one thing was clear. Pierce couldn't sell bluegrass, and even more unfortunate, by 1967, he couldn't sell his country music albums either. According to Pierce, the industry just didn't allow for the, quote, older, more traditional type of music that I made. While shopping Starday to potential buyers in 1968, Pierce received word that his close friend, his mentor, and friendly competitor, Sid Nathan of King Records, had just passed away. Pierce found a buyer for Starday. It was Nashville-based Lynn Broadcasting in 1968, and he suggested that they also buy the King label. The deal went down at a Shoney's, which is, by the way, where all business goes down if you're in Nashville, Tennessee. Starday was sold for $2.7 million, and the King label at the time was viewed as a throw-in for $2.5 million. The Starday King venture, operated by Hal Neely, was short-lived, lasting only 3 years, but the Starday Studio managed to produce some of James Brown's most important recordings during this time, including Get Up, parentheses, I Feel Like Being a, parentheses, Sex Machine, as well as Super Bad and many more soul classics. Rumor even has it that it was Brown himself who demanded the outer facade of the Starday studio be painted from its original white color at the time that Pierce sold it to its current shade of brown out on Dickerson Pike. Unfortunately, the country sales continued a downward spiral. James Brown's contract was sold to Polydor in 1971 in July, and a few months later, the rest of the Starday catalog was sold for $1.4 million. That is a huge loss, several million dollars loss for Lynn. Though Starday has since been revived for a few releases here and there by current owner Mo Lytle, 1971 essentially marked the end of an era. Within the past 5 years, the role of the independent record label has emerged as a dominant discourse in popular music scholarship. We've seen new books documenting the history of Sun Records, Atlantic, Chess, Stax, Motown, Rounder, Folkways, Trumpet, Blue Note, Def Jam, Casablanca, John Brovin's amazing Record Makers and Breakers, as well as two books concerning King Records. That's about a 5 or 6 year period right there. It's pretty remarkable. And you can consult Tim Brooks' column on the Ars Journal for even more feature articles on independent labels. The ways that these labels operated and marketed their music greatly shaped American popular culture. And I hope that in the future, the Starday name will be included in these discussions concerning America's most important labels. Perhaps Starday's greatest contribution to American culture was its sheer volume of production. Between 1953 and 1970, Sun Records, which gets a lot of attention in popular music circles, as it should, they released 323 singles and 20 LPs. I just like to compare that to Starday, which in the same time period released 2,200 country music singles, NEPs, and more than 500 LPs. Significant. In its first incarnation, Starday documented the rich musical history of East Texas, as well as privately pressed country music from all over the United States. As a renegade Nashville independent, Starday found creative ways to keep bluegrass and traditional country music alive through one of the country music's most turbulent times. One of the reasons I think Starday is often excluded from these talks about independent record labels is that today, the Starday catalog remains locked away in a vault, for the most part unreleased, unorganized, and uncared for by its owner. When I discussed it with Mo Lytle, the few times I've talked with him on the phone, he says that absolutely nothing important came out of Starday before he revived the label and released Red Sovine's Million Seller in 1976. But I certainly disagree. And it is my hope, as Don Pierce originally set out to preserve our nation's musical heritage, I hope that talks like this, my paper, as well as the Starday book that Mississippi just put out, are just a few of the many steps towards preserving both the Starday legacy and our nation's musical heritage. Thank you.
I'm just thinking as I'm listening to Nate's presentation, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. The diversity, we talked about Arsk again, and okay, there's jazz over there, and it's jazz. And we started with country, and we went to jazz with Bob Wills, and got a little bluegrass here, little James Brown, which I'm sure nobody expected to hear at this end. And that's just the diversity of all these subjects, and it's papers like Nate's and Tom's that really, I think, make Arsk wonderful. We've got time for questions. Anybody has any that can come up and answer? Is that Bill?
Yeah, Bill.
Yeah.
Now you remember me.
Yeah, who's the question for?
Well, for Nate.
Okay, Nate, come on up so we can record it.
Your research, did you find any information about the Brunner record label, of course, which was owned by the Beach Boys, but was a King subsidiary that recorded one album with a group called The Flame?
Have I heard about The Flame and the Brother record label is the question in my research. And Starday, when they merged with King, consumed a lot of subsidiary labels. Things like Volunteer was another one that they did, and Brother label. And I don't focus too much on that. What I tried to do was just, with the discography, there's a 70-page discography in the back that I really tried to focus on all of the Starday up until the King merger. And once that King merger happened is really when I, and Don Pierce sold out, that's really when my research sort of ends.
Right, because it's kind of an anomaly before, you know, the Starday gang, you know, to come up with something like that. That weren't even Americans, you know, they were involved with an American-based label.
Absolutely, absolutely. Any other questions?
Chris?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment about Tom
Johnson, who was one of Bob Wills' early guitar players, and I happened to ask him, how did you learn all these blues? Like, I walked from Dallas clear into Wichita Falls. And he said, in his vernacular, I hate to use it, but he said, well, we just went to the furniture store and listened to all the nigger records. And you see, they were all unbelievably influenced by black music of all kinds, every one of those musicians. And that's what made them so hot.
The musicians told me that often they, after their gig was over, they'd go to the jazz clubs and see the black bands.
Anybody else? Okay, well, we're just about on time. Lunchtime, we have 75 minutes, 1:40.